You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Well, I guess the important thing is that we can actually, because we've got a small economy, move fairly quickly versus, say, you know, really large economies like, I don't know, the UK or the US or China and so on. And so we've got demonstration value. And so when we say that we're going to become carbon neutral and we move really quickly on that, what that does is it demonstrates to other developed countries that are perhaps a bit larger and might be a bit more nervous about it, that it's possible. And with any luck, they follow our lead.
One of the things that often rears its head at these sort of international events is the idea that climate change doesn't necessarily complement the idea of sovereignty so well. It seems to sort of, well, it does. It goes beyond borders. It doesn't recognise these constructions that we have. Do you think it's realistic to expect that this group of countries that produce only 1% or less, adding up to be 25% of the entire world emissions, is it realistic to think that all these parties will, in a way, let go of some of their sovereignty and focus on a wider issue?
Well, I don't know that it involves letting go of your sovereignty. You know, every country in the world is obliged to become carbon neutral in the second half of this century. The whole point of the Paris Agreement was, I guess, an appreciation that every country has its own unique set of circumstances. And so it kind of allows for a bit of flexibility in how we approach that, you know, and how each individual country approaches that. And that all of that collectively, you know, adds up to holding global warming to between 1.5 and 2 degrees. Now, you know, we're not there yet. We're still at the beginning of this process. And, you know, the whole world really seriously needs to ratchet up its ambition if we're going to succeed in, over the coming kind of few decades. But I think it's a pretty solid process overall because it actually does allow for countries to, you know, manage themselves with a fair degree of flexibility.
Fiji is hosting, or sorry, chairing this conference, the COP23. Do you think having a Pacific island, a Pacific nation, as the face of this conference is giving it a more a real feeling to people out there who might be less concerned or less involved?
Yeah, I do. I actually think it's been really significant that Fiji, a small island state, has been acting in the role of the chair of the conference because they have managed to introduce into the agenda a particular focus on not just other island states, but particularly vulnerable and small countries that don't have a lot of resources, to put the spotlight on the kind of urgency and the scale of the crisis that they're facing. And I think a number of the initiatives that came out of this conference were a response to that. And I know, actually, I mean, New Zealand has got an incredibly warm reception here for the stand that we're taking in terms of becoming carbon neutral. And I think, you know, part of that is coming from those countries saying, this is the kind of leadership we need. We need more countries to get on board that wagon if we're going to have any hope of survival. And so that then starts to generate its own momentum.
Getting on the wagon is one of the trickiest things about this. I mean, the Paris Climate Agreement, recently Syria signed up, and leaving the United States as the only country in the world not as a member, but they are a pretty significant country. It makes me think of, as well, New Zealand last night signed up to the Powering Past Coal Alliance, but currently in the United States there's a large rhetoric about redeveloping the coal industry. Do you think there is a way that we need to be broaching these economic incentives of these large states with wider global environmental concerns, or at this stage is it still too divided to actually work progressively together?
Well, I mean, it's actually interesting that the Americans are still at the at COP23 in Bonn and were still engaging in the process about, you know, what is the kind of set of global rules that we're trying to come up with for ourselves to do this. And that there are so many US cities and states that were represented saying, we're still in, we're still committed, we're going to do this. But ultimately, actually, I mean, particularly when it comes to coal, the economics of it are changing so rapidly that, you know, while President Trump and the, you know, his administration may want to try and revive the coal industry, actually people aren't buying it because solar and wind are now cheaper per megawatt hour than coal is, and that's just shifted in the last few years. So the economics of things have really moved so greatly that I think it almost doesn't matter what those who are really pro-coal think anymore.
So currently off the coast of New Zealand, there is still seismic drilling and research being carried out by international oil organisations and companies. Is this something that you're wanting to address as we move forward, potentially once you return to New Zealand?
Yes, it is. I mean, look, you know, fossil fuels are a sunset industry. And, you know, we've made a commitment in New Zealand that over the course of the coming decades, we're going to be phasing those out. We've got a commitment in this government that will replace the government's car fleet with full electrics, you know, by 2025, which is, you know, pretty soon. And I just think the world is moving in our direction here. And the, you know, the fossil fuel industry is kind of on its way out. What we need to do is we need to work out what we call a just transition plan for all the, you know, people who work in those industries and in those communities to ensure that we're able to still utilise their skills and they're still able to earn a living. And so that means that the government's really got to take an active leadership role in working out what are the replacement industries that are more sustainable with good, you know, green jobs, but that, you know, pay well and utilise the skills that those people have got.
So finally, I wanted to bring up the fact that you have reaffirmed New Zealand's commitment to supporting our Pacific neighbours to adapt their infrastructure as climate change progresses. What does this mean to you when you say adapt the infrastructure? Is this literally, is this a monetary commitment or is this training and education? Is this cultural exchange? How would this work?
Well, it's all of the above. I mean, there is a pretty substantial financial contribution. You know, we've put in $200 million into promoting solar energy in the Pacific. And that both, that does two things. Is it helps with the resilience of the islands, so they're not actually having to import diesel from overseas because they're generating power locally. It helps them to reduce their own greenhouse gas emissions, not that they're very high to start with, but, you know, the islands themselves also want to make sure that they get carbon neutral at some point. And it also lowers their costs because solar energy is actually cheaper than diesel, especially imported diesel when it has to go all that way. And so you've got a kind of multiple wins there. And so what we would say is that that is the kind of, you know, climate-related aid that both helps them to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and also adapt to changing times to make them more resilient.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.